Tonight on Arena, A Quiet Place Part 2, Land and Dream Horse, three films with actual cinema releases up for review, and Marina Carr on her stage adaptation of To the Lighthouse. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we start with those films up for review this evening. Three that you can go and see in an actual cinema from next Monday, June the 7th. Dream Horse looks at the true story of a Welsh village that bought a racehorse that went on to race in the Welsh Grand National. In Land, Robin Wright stars in and directs a drama centred on the self-imposed isolation of a woman in the throes of devastating loss. But we'll start with A Quiet Place Part 2, starring Cillian Murphy. It's the sequel to the hugely successful A Quiet Place from husband and wife team Emily Blunt and John Krasinski. It's due to be released in cinemas a year ago, but for obvious reasons we're only getting it now. We have Gemma Cray and Michael Pope are our two reviewers on this Thursday evening. Evelyn Abbott, Emily Blunt, still struggling to find safety with her children without her husband. Gemma, remind us of the premise for A Quiet Place and how successful that first film actually was.
Yeah, it did something so unusual. In most films nowadays are very, very dialogue heavy. And the whole premise of it is that it's a post-apocalyptic world. There are these very terrifying, scary, almost impenetrable monsters that move super fast, but they're completely blind and very sensitive to sound. So all the characters have to be as quiet as possible. And on screen, it's so eerie to watch. It ramps up the tension and it changes the feel of the film. Like it's stunning. Mm.
Michael, how much do we need to know about A Quiet Place Part 1, if you like, going into this film? Because I believe it takes up right where the previous film stopped.
In a way, yes. It's just more, there's an intro that's kind of, I guess John Krasinski has written himself into this movie, even despite the fact that he's not alive in this movie. There's kind of a very strong kind of Spielberg-esque All-American opening at a baseball game where we see you could call it the first landing of these creatures, aliens, I suppose we know them to be now. It's nothing new from the smash and grab monster stuff from the first one, but it's a slice of kind of well executed carnage, if you will. And then we flash forward right to the moment where A Quiet Place, the original, ends, and we're kind of Evelyn, played by Emily Blunt, husband's dead, and the aliens they know now are vulnerable to kind of amplified feedback. So they're there on the road, and they're trying to find safe harbor with the daughter Reagan, who's deaf, Marcus, the young son, and also this newborn baby they had in the first one, that they keep in this sealed case with oxygen, because obviously if it's crying, it's going to attract the aliens. So they come across temporary salvation in the form of Emmett, their old neighbour who's grieving, played by Cillian Murphy. He set up camp in this abandoned factory. It's like this grim hideout where he's living, and they have the daughter hears this kind of like radio signal just playing on a loop beyond the sea, and she thinks this is some kind of cloaked message from survivors, which begs the question, why don't they just say, you know, we are survivors? But I guess, you know, maybe the aliens have been taking English classes in between movies. So that's kind of the setup, as it were.
Well, let's listen to a scene featuring the aforementioned Evelyn Emily Blunt asking Emmett, played by Cillian Murphy, who had disappeared but didn't come back, to look for survivors, and she wants to know why, and obviously they have to be very quiet.
Did you ever think to come for us?
No. The people that are left, what they've become. You don't know, do you? I do. They're not the kind of people worth saving.
And there we have Cillian Murphy and Emily Blunt in a scene there from A Quiet Place Part 2. Gemma, we get a sense even in that scene. Obviously, the amount of dialogue that we get here is minimal, and when it is spoken, it's whispered in the fashion that we've just heard. What does that mean in terms of the sound design and the score for the film? They're more important than ever, I guess.
Yeah, that what is, I think, brings the tension, and it's what makes this a standout horror sci-fi film and differentiates it from anything else, because so much more weight is carried in the performances, in the subtext, in the relationships, in that tension. And the some like the jump scares, the pacing. I kind of find like when it's so quiet, like and a monster appears out of nowhere, you feel it in your body, especially when you're in the cinema. And it was so nice to be in the cinema to watch this.
Yes, because even the previews are back in cinemas now as well, for the most part, which means you're getting to see them on the big screen. Performances here, Michael, I believe Millicent Simmons, who herself is a deaf actor, you were impressed by her and the chemistry between her and Cillian Murphy.
Very much so. I mean, no one's better at kind of displaying kind of desperation and kind of like ragged edge kind of anxiety than Cillian Murphy. And Millicent Simmons, she's really wonderful. I mean, in a way, I kind of thought that it might have been an idea to kind of set this film apart and maybe focus on just one character or two characters rather than kind of going back into the family, because she's so strong. She really could have carried this film herself. I mean, Marcus, the younger son, and Evelyn kind of have their own B plot, and it's more or less the same kind of well executed bumps and jumps as the first one. But it's really when we're with Millicent that the stuff is really, really strong. And I feel Emily Blunt, bizarrely, because she's John Krasinski's wife, is really underserved by the material. She's not really given much new stuff to do. It's all kind of the same beats. She's kind of on the verge of tears most of the time, and she's walking around trying to be quiet. It's not, I mean, considering just a 10-minute sequence at the start of the film that doesn't really add anything to the plot, they could have really taken 5 minutes to examine her grief at losing her husband literally minutes before the film started. Instead, we kind of got just kind of, for me, it was kind of more retreads of some of the other stuff from the first one. I know I sound surly, I'm not a bad person, and I'm as excited to be in the cinema as much as anybody, but I did think it was kind of a diminishing returns from the first one.
And stars then from you, Michael?
I'm sorry, it's 2 out of 5 for me.
2 out of 5, so you're delighted to be back in the cinema, but
I am
not
very
that delighted with this film. What about you, Gemma, overall? I'm guessing that this is set up for A Quiet Place parts 3 to whatever.
There's always a monster that can pop out of like under a bush at any stage, so it's always set upable. I thought it does, and I totally get Michael's points, and I do agree with them. There's so many plot holes, but that's not really what this felt like. This isn't a plot or structure film. It's about the visceral experience, and that's what I thought it really delivered on. So I think 4 stars. Now, again, it could be desperation because it's been so long since I've been in a cinema and I enjoyed it so much. But I just thought it had the sound mix, the jump scares, the sequences were so tense. Thought it was great.
Enough in it for you in that respect. So a big difference of opinion there. 2 stars from Michael, 4 stars from Gemma. Let's move on then to Land. And if you're listening to the programme on Tuesday evening, you'll have heard our interview with Robin Wright speaking about her feature film directorial debut. She stars alongside Damien Bashir. Wright plays a woman seeking isolation and solitude as she comes to terms with a huge tragedy in her life. That's the basic setup, and it's quite a small and despite the fact that we're in a big expansive countryside, it's quite a small studio piece, chamber piece in some ways, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, she is getting over. She is in the aftermath of a personal tragedy. She's unable to stay connected to the world, and even the sister that she has, who loves her and asks her to endure and persevere. So she heads off. She retreats to this magnificent kind of unforgiving solitude of a wood cabin in the wilds of the Rockies. She's no car. She has no people. She has looks like kind of small rations, and as far as she's concerned, she has no real future. It's just her and her grief. So she's committed to this isolation, but within a few minutes she kind of finds herself out of her depth. She's definitely no Bear Grylls, and things deteriorate to such a degree that her life hangs in the balance. And that's kind of where Miguel, played by Damien Bashir, he's this kind of kind hunter.
He comes into her life. Let's listen to the point at which she's retreating to the cabin in the Rockies, starting out, owned by the father of a local man, Colt, played here by Brad Leyland. He's guided her up to the cabin. She wants to be left completely alone. He's not so keen on that idea.
Hell, I haven't done anything to it since the old man died over about a year and a half ago. Left all his stuff in there. There's no telling what's in there.
Well, I've got some time.
It's pretty country, though, ain't it? This is all hunting land here. Yours. That way butts up to the Shoshone National Forest and tribal lands. You shouldn't have any problem with trespassers.
I was wondering if you could help me out with something.
Shoot.
Would you mind finding someone to pick up the rental car and the trailer and drop it at U-Haul for me?
It's not a good idea for anybody to be out here without a vehicle.
Oh, I'll be fine.
You ever been living in parts like these before? You said your family was from the city.
I appreciate you guiding me up here, Colt. And if you feel that you can help me, I'll leave the keys and the money right here on the bench.
Robin Wright and Brad Leyland there in a scene from Land. Gemma, Michael says it's quite quickly after that that she is in deep trouble and she realises that the character of Colt that we heard there, in fact, she should have heeded his warnings. But really, it's when Damien Bashir's character comes into play here that the story starts to unfold. But it takes its time. They're in no rush to even explain who he is and the kind of dynamic that's between.
That's what's enjoyable about this. But yeah, you're totally right. So he arrives in when she is, her whole place has been ransacked. She has no food. She's on the ground. She's about to freeze to death. And he arrives in sort of a happenstance, but it's hinted at that maybe it's fate. But it's sort of like they're two complex people that bond over getting to know the land and spending time together in the land, and they don't really have many deep conversations other than what they do. It takes its time, but what I thought as well was very, very interesting about the way it was structured is the different sequences. So if you look at the very beginning of the film, she's in I think it's Chicago. She's in the big city anyway, planning on leaving. Every sequence has a different color, different pace. The first one is so dark and it's so kind of slow paced and very difficult. And then as soon as he comes in, you can see like even the color grading starts to change. I think it's something that it's subtle and it's a very, very low key film, but it's definitely done very well.
The other thing that plays a huge part in this, apart from the actors themselves, is the landscape. Some amazing scenery, but it's almost as if the landscape is and the setting is a character in and of itself, Michael.
Yeah, the cinematographer is not one I've heard of. He's a fella called Bobby Bukowski. And I was reading about it there during doing my research, and he shot it where he could with mostly natural light. So you can tell sometimes that might not be the case, especially with snowstorms and such. But if you like your wilderness montages and some really visceral kind of images of kind of wildlife and what it'd be like to be a human being, a city boy or a city person in this kind of vast expanse, it's kind of perfect. It's some of the scenes as well. I mean, she is kind of, without giving too much away, she's kind of haunted by memories and kind of images from the past, but there's no kind of like wispy kind of flashbacks. Well, there is one or two, but there's actually kind of these moments of where one of her memories kind of literally hugs her on screen at one point, and it's devastating, it's upsetting. It's out of step with the kind of sense of verisimilitude that the film has, but it works really, really well.
And the other aspect of things here, obviously, Gemma, is the fact that Robin Wright stars in and directs it. Now, the character has quite an emotional journey to go through. I spoke to her about this. Big emotional journeys and big, you know, emotional scenes to play at different times. And she has to pop out of that and then come out and direct the scene as well. How did she manage balancing those two roles, do you think?
She's Robin Wright. So yeah. As an actor, you can definitely not say that she lacks in any talent. I do think this film would have benefited from having that outside view and that outside perspective. Like, they were doing a location shoot for 29 days on the side of a mountain where they were actually there and sleeping there and living there. And you can't imagine how difficult something like that would be to stay in character and to change to change kind of moods between each shot, kind of dealing with the weather as it comes. So I think she did as good a job as possible, but I would have loved to have seen what she can do. Like, she's proved her acting chops already.
Yeah.
She's proved her directing chops with this, but I think I would love to see what she does next, because I think she could really take it to the next level.
Yeah, and again, I think I wasn't the only one to ask her this. When I asked her about the fact that she, how the decision came for her to play it, it was purely production schedules. They had other people in mind, but they couldn't get them. They couldn't fit them in as it turned out. So she said, well, why don't I do it? And that was how that happened. The just one thing on the chemistry between Bashir and Robin Wright here. It's an interesting chemistry, because the kind of the potential for a love story is kind of pushed to the one side fairly quickly, Michael.
Yeah, this is for 2 seconds I was wondered that this wasn't going to be platonic, but it becomes quickly evident that it is. They work really well together. It's not, their chemistry isn't quite as remarkable as it needs to be, because, you know, it's very functional. They have to learn to hunt and forage and cook, and at one point they talk about Star Wars, which kind of really didn't work for me. But I do feel by the end, and there is a kind of a big kind of, not a twist, but there's a very emotional payoff at the end. A couple more well-constructed scenes and dynamic moments between the two of them might have made that work better. But as it stands, it's kind of, you know, it is intense and it is atmospheric, you know.
Stars from you then, Michael?
I'll give it 3.5 out of 5.
3.5 out of 5. What are you saying, Gemma?
We're on agreement to this one, so I think it's solid and timely, and 3.5 as well.
3.5 out of 5 from both of you then. Let's move on then to Dream Horse, the true story, or based on a true story at any rate, of an unlikely racehorse bred by a small town Welsh bartender, Jan Vokes, played by Toni Collette. Based on a true story here, I mean, you actually couldn't make this story up, really and truly, Michael.
Well, I think everything you need to know from this film, you would get from the poster. Which is just basically the whole ensemble smiling and kind of like, you know, it's kind of wonderful and magical. But yeah, Toni Collette plays Jan. She's kind of this South Wales native in this kind of declining mining town, and her children have left, and her husband is this kind of toothless, kind of sitting around, parks himself in front of the television, and she bartends and works down the local supermarket. But her interest is piqued by this kind of loudmouth Paul Braggart, played by Damian Lewis. So she, in horse racing, in breeding a horse and racing a horse, so she informs Brian that they're going to buy a mare with the aim of breeding this competitive racehorse. And they realise quickly enough that this would be impossible. So she drafts in this local mob of kind of colourful investors, which you can imagine, including Howard, the Damian Lewis's character, and his middle class finance pals, to fund the considerable costs of, you know, insemination and raising the offspring and training. And then the foal is born, and it's dubbed, and it's called Dream Alliance.
Well, don't tell us anything about the foal, because we're going to have the moment when Toni Collette goes in and sees the foal speaks directly to the foal.
So you got a name, Dream Alliance. What do you think? One time when I was a girl, Dad and me took Sammy and Murphy, our whippets, to a dog show in Pontypridd. Didn't think we had a hope in hell, as nobody's from the back of beyond. But we got first and second prize. Dad was so proud of me. Took me for a milkshake at Gamberini's Cafe after to celebrate. Seemed like anything was possible.
Toni Collette in a scene there from Dream Horse. Gemma, you know, if this was an Irish film, we'd be on to the accents immediately and saying, oh, it goes everywhere from Kerry to Donegal. I don't know if that goes from Cardiff to Holyhead or not. And I guess we can't really judge that. But to an Irish ear, it sounds like a good Welsh accent, as does Damian Lewis. And all of those involved in the film seem to hit the accent.
Yeah, well, from my very limited experience from owning a Catatoni album when I was a tween, I give it a pass. Like, especially because she is from Australia. Yeah. So it's a very, very, very different voice, like accent to carry. But like, just when you don't think I could fall more in love with Toni Collette, she just does such a fantastic performance in this. She is so warm and earthy and fiery in that very true way of those women that are part of the community that help out all the time but are tough as nails as well. I just think she personifies it so perfectly.
And warm and earthy, two of the words that Gemma used to describe the character played by Toni Collette, and indeed her own the performance of Toni Collette. That could describe the film itself in many ways, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, you've seen this film a number of times. You've seen Callum the Girls, Full Monty, Waking Ned, Little Voice, Lady in the Van. If you want This Is England, you've come to the wrong, you know, cozy Welsh village. You know this movie. You know, it's got the rabble of quirky Brits and kind of like, you know, it's got some highs, some lows, some hurdles. Sorry about that.
Really?
You know, it's all inspirational sports beats are present and correct. And that's not a bad thing. It's outrageously middle of the road. It does have a TV quality to it, you know, and it's kind of old fashioned in the way it portrays men and women and alcoholism and all that, but it doesn't really matter because it's hard to be too cynical or too mean spirited about such single-minded feel-goodery, you know.
Yeah, we've got to say feel-good is the desired quality, I think, at the end of this movie, and you know you're not going to be disappointed on that score at any rate. Gemma, was there anything missing? You felt good, I think, but was there anything missing for you in the storytelling or in the story?
No, I mean it is based on a true story, and yeah. All that stuff genuinely did happen, and it takes great fun in itself. I think as Irish people, we are not used and we do not like things being so earnest. And I wonder, is there a little bit of things that are challenging for us when we're a lot more like, rather than us making like the full Monty, are we a bit more like the existential dark films about land? Is that more our scope? So I think this, it's such a sweet, warm, beautiful film, and yeah, definitely doesn't reinvent the wagon wheel. I know that was worse, sorry.
But, it was.
But I don't know, I just thought it was warm, well-paced, and just really satisfying. Yes.
Yeah, and
I give it 4 stars.
Right, and from what you know of horse racing, 4 stars from Gemma, what you know of horse racing, because there are a few races that are portrayed in it, that seemed to work pretty well as well, Michael, as you head towards giving us your stars as well.
Yeah, and it's always nice to see a horse and hound on the big screen, because the last time I saw it was in Notting Hill, so, you know, as a big horse and hound subscriber, I'm delighted. I'd give it a 3 out of 5, which is not, it's a cosy, comfortable watch. My parents are going to love it.
All right. There'll be people who themselves and their parents will love this film, I think. Michael Pope and Gemma Cray. What did you say, sorry, Michael, in terms
3
of...
3 out of 5.
3 out of 5, sorry. Okay. Michael Pope and Gemma Cray there speaking to us about Land, Dream Horse and A Quiet Place 2, which will be available in cinemas. Do you remember those places? In cinemas from this Monday, the 7th of June. Published in 1927, To the Lighthouse is Virginia Woolf's 5th novel, A Haunting Work, in which we meet the Ramsay family in 1910 and then again in 1920, during which the passage of time and World War I have taken their toll. Marina Carr has now adapted the Virginia Woolf novel for the stage. Annabel Cumann directs, Derva Crotty and Declan Conlon play Mr. and Mrs. Ramsay, the fictional characters, and Virginia and Leonard Woolf, the real-life author and her husband. It will be broadcast from the Everyman Theatre as part of Cork Midsummer Festival from June the 25th through until June the 27th. And Marina Carr joins me now. We can't do the fanfare just yet as I could for cinemas, Marina. Theatres haven't arrived at that point yet. But the adaptation of choosing To the Lighthouse, first of all, what was it about Virginia Woolf and that particular novel that attracted you as a potential piece of work for the stage, Marie?
Well, choosing Virginia Woolf wasn't difficult. Talking to Annabel over the years, and we both love her and both have been reading her for a very long time and revere the woman, and mostly, more than anything, revere the work. So it wasn't a difficult decision. Landing on To the Lighthouse, I mean, there's so many great Virginia Woolf books you could adapt. But I suppose The Waves was gone. Katie Mitchell did that. And then Vanessa Redgrave did a wonderful film of Mrs. Dalloway. And Orlando had been done with Tilda Swinton. Mm. So To the Lighthouse, I suppose, it's a big challenge as well. Mm. But it's also one of those books I would go back to over and over again.
The challenges, it struck me, are manifold, really, in adapting this, not least of which there's very little dialogue in the book. That's one aspect which makes it difficult for a playwright, where people have to speak to us and tell us things on stage to bring us along. The focus moves around from character to character in terms of the thoughts that we're hearing expressed in the novel itself. And it's not overladen with plot. You know, so there are several several challenges when you went to do this.
Yes, I mean, it is a very intimate interior book, but you know, it's very, you know, it's in a way it lends itself fantastically to the theatre. So all you do is what they're thinking. You just turn that into dialogue. You know, there are very few of my lines in this adaptation, because our own language is so rich and so extraordinary, and you want to get as many of her lines and her images down there on the page. So once I hit upon that convention that you have the characters actually speaking what they're thinking, and it actually makes it quite funny as well. But talking about plot, I mean, there is a plot. I mean, there's the passage of time. There's before the war, the Great War, between the war and then after the war. So there's a fantastic journey they go on. But I suppose mostly to the lighthouse is kind of a love poem from Virginia Woolf to her parents, the parents that she adored and had very complex relationships with.
Yeah, and they are the Mr. and Mrs. Ramsay of the piece. You know, when I mentioned, I think, at the beginning of the programme that it's considered often to the Lighthouse to be one of Woolf's most autobiographical works, but not about her own life per se, but really about this really treats her parents. What was it? Mrs. Ramsay is the more important, I think it's safe to say, of the two characters.
Yeah.
How would you describe her? What kind of mother does Virginia Woolf show us in Mrs. Ramsay?
Well, she shows this kind of, she is kind of, not without wanting to define what the title is, because the title is so enigmatic itself. Everybody wonders what does that title mean to the lighthouse? But I think in a way, Mrs. Ramsay is the lighthouse for the family, for her husband and for her eight children and for all the visitors who are in this summer house. Virginia Woolf herself said she was obsessed with her mother until she wrote to the lighthouse, and she wrote it in her 40s. And she talks about the mother with such love and adoration. You know, she says, like, living voices in many parts of the world still speak of her as of someone who is actually a fact in life, whether she came merry, wrathful, or in impulsive sympathy, it does not matter. They speak of her as of a thing that happened, recalling as though all round her grew significant how she stood and turned and how the bird sang loudly or a great cloud passed across the sky. I mean, it's a very romantic evocation of the childhood and the time. And yet it manages to carry within that romanticism the fracture and fragmentation of the family and of the world and of her as an artist.
Yeah, and it's an important aspect, I suppose. You talk about the coterie of friends and acquaintances and other characters that are present in this holiday home. And when I said there's no plot, in fact, I was thinking today as I was looking through parts of the script, you know, lots of things do happen in the way they happen in real life. You know, there may be no huge big plot turning moments in it, if you like, in some ways. They're constantly talking to each other. They're constantly telling each other what, as you say, they're thinking, and they're getting on with the business of what they're doing on the day. How artistic a household is the one that we're given in To the Lighthouse and in your adaptation?
Well, incredibly, because you've got Lily Briscoe there, who's the apprentice painter, the apprentice artist, and then you have Carmichael, played by Alwyn Fuere, who is the finished artist, you know, who is the great poet, who's, you know, addicted to opium and reading Persian and Virgil till all hours and hardly has a word to say, but he writes magnificently. And then you have Lily, who I kind of think is a younger Virginia, who's trying to capture what she says, the thing itself before it becomes something else, before it becomes fixed. And the conversation around art and beauty is magnificent in this book. So this struggle, and then you've Mr. Ramsay, who's a great philosopher, but he's stuck on Q. You know, he says if thought is the alphabet, I can get to Q, no problem, but R eludes him. You know, so you've all this. So you have this huge conversation around identity and fracture, and everybody's scrapping away and hating each other and loving each other. And Mrs. Ramsay, kind of this beacon in the middle, bringing them all together.
And as I said,
and then
Mrs. Ramsey, played by Deborah Crotty. Mr. Ramsey, played by Declan Conlon. Lily, who you mentioned there,
yeah,
played by Aoife Duffin, Banks McNabb, Nick Dunning, and Alwyn Fuere playing the character of Carmichael, who is Augustus in the novel. But obviously, with Alwyn playing it, you're going for a gender-blind aspect to that. However,
well, I don't know. Augustus Carmichael, yeah. I mean, what a cast we have, you know? Mm. And what a director, a cracking cast. Sorry, I interrupted there, Sean.
What I was going to say was, from my knowledge of the novel, nowhere does Virginia Woolf or Leonard Woolf appear. So this is a big part of the invention that you have brought into the piece. By bringing those characters in, and it's Deborah Crotty playing Mrs. Ramsey and Virginia Woolf, Declan Conlon playing Mr. Ramsey and Leonard Woolf. What were you exploring in and around that dual casting and writing the two characters for the two actors?
Well, in a way, a couple of things. We all become our mothers and fathers, you know? What's a great wild line, you know? Oh, I forget it. What I'm referring.
Is it every man becomes his father, every woman doesn't, but no woman becomes her mother, and that's his tragedy. I haven't got the exact rhyme, but somebody will send it in and correct us.
Yes, somebody, no doubt someone will correct us. But the other thing was, and I mean, Annabelle and myself debated this for a long time, in or out or in, because in a way, because it's a work of art, it's full of, you know, what Virginia Woolf herself calls golden champagne, you know. So it's an idealized version of the parents, with some caveats and you know, detailing the father's absolute devastation when Mrs. Ramsey dies and how the family picks themselves up after the death of Mrs. Ramsey and the death of two of the siblings and how they finally get to the lighthouse. But I also thought, you know, I just wanted, I don't know why, but I just wanted her there talking about the writing of that book, seeing as the book itself is so concerned with creation and how one captures the thing before it becomes fixed. And also, I suppose, because she wrote this book effortlessly, but you know, anyone who knows a bit about her biography, there was a huge struggle in the life. And also there was a huge marriage there. It was almost a 30-year marriage with Leonard Woolf. And he was incredibly supportive of her. I mean, it wasn't without its difficulties, but he looked after her. He, you know, they established the Hogarth Press together. They published all her books. He minded her. He put her to bed when she wasn't feeling well. He insisted on certain things that drove her mad, of course. But he was trying to look after her. So I wanted to capture something of that, yes, because there's something about the fracture between Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey that is replicated in Virginia Woolf and Leonard Woolf in their marriage, despite the great love. You know, it's love, hate, it's attraction, repulsion, that kind of thing.
Yes, yeah. By the way, I have it now. All women become their mothers. That is their tragedy. No man does, and that is his. That's the Oscar Wilde quote we were looking for.
That's it.
How important is the First World War in this story? And because it really divides the story in many ways, in part one and part two. Of both, there's three parts, I suppose, but the first and third part give us that it's the First World War that is the fracture in between. How important is that in the telling of the story, do you think?
Very important, because I think part one is you're dealing with, you know, late Victorian Edwardian society and all those restrictions and mores and ideas around what men should be and what women should be. And they're already fracturing before the war. Around this, it's happening. And then, you know, during the war, part two, time passes, is during the war and the fracture is happening and has happened. And then part three is after the war, where everything has absolutely changed. I mean, they talk about, I don't have the facts now, but the death toll of young men in the Great War was devastating. And because they were so absent during the war, women came to the fore, like they took on jobs they never would have had, and they began to, you know, move out into the world. And, you know, the whole feminist movement, the whole, all of that was happening. And all the ideas around art and form and subject and object and identity were called hugely into question, I think, by the barbarity and catastrophe that was the Great War.
And of course,
women, on all of that, yeah.
The women may have had, you know, moments of liberation during the war in terms of getting out and doing things that they just wouldn't have been allowed to do previous to that. But I'm sure they felt cheated a bit by it subsequently.
Yeah, but then, you know, like who came back was the other thing. You know, an awful lot didn't come back. So you had a whole generation of women, you know, who didn't marry as well. And Lily Briscoe is kind of that character. Like Mrs. Ramsay just thinks everyone should marry. And Lily in part three, when she's missing Mrs. Ramsay, who's dead, she said, but what did she actually do? You know, she wrote letters and she told people to marry. You know, she said, what was the spirit in you? You know, nobody can actually define who Mrs. Ramsay is, except she is this extraordinary presence. As Virginia speaks about, that people still spoke about her. And, you know, she was this great beauty also as a young woman. And she was painted by her photograph by her aunt. I forget the name. I should have all these names, but it's gone from me. And she was like one of these classic beauties. And she had been married before. She married Leslie Stephen. I'm talking about Virginia Woolf's mother now.
Yes.
Julia. So she'd been married before. And she had this, she carried this kind of pall of tragedy around her. So people put everything onto her because she was so beautiful and because she was so still and because she kept telling people to get married and she'd worry about the dinner and, you know, she'd all these children and she was trying to create this kind of perfect domestic life. But then Virginia goes into the interior of Mrs. Ramsay, where, you know, when the children are gone to bed and she's got 5 minutes and Mr. Ramsay has stopped hounding her to tell him that he's a genius and she's got 5 minutes and she descends. And there's a wonderful description where she says she becomes this wedge-shaped core of darkness, you know, and I rise now and again and that is how you see me by. But that I can only be myself as this wedge-shaped core of darkness, you know, that is, you know, seeping. So you have this image, which of course is reflected in the painting Lily is trying to do of
herself,
like purple shadow.
Yeah. clearly the novel has spoken to you very deeply and it has been growing in your mind for some time. Looking forward to seeing the adaptation. Obviously this will be an online presentation. Can't wait until we get to a point, Marina, where we can see things in the theatre again. But thanks for being with us this evening.
Yes. Thank you, Sean.
Thanks, that's Marina Carr there. And To the Lighthouse, Marina's adaptation of the Virginia Woolf novel, is presented by Hatch Theatre and the Everyman Theatre. It's available online from the 25th through until the 27th of June as part of Cork Midsummer Festival. And you can find out further details on everymancork.com. D.H. Lawrence remains one of the most divisive figures in 20th century literature. Burning Man, a biography by Francis Wilson, attempts to reconcile the many contradictions and complexities of the man and the artist. Lawrence, a minor son, exploded onto the literary scene with works that explored class, familial relations and sex. Among his great works are Sons and Lovers, Women in Love, The Rainbow and Lady Chatterley's Lover. Let's start with a clip from Ken Russell's film of Women in Love. Alan Bates, playing Rupert Birkin, gives instructions on how to eat a fig.
The proper way to eat a fig in society is to split it in four, holding it by the stump, and open it so that it is a glittering, rosy, moist, honeyed, heavy-petaled, four-petaled flower. Then you throw away the skin after you have taken off the blossom with your lips.
Yes, a little more than fig eating, I think, in the mind of D.H. Lawrence in that particular piece of writing, and none of it lost in Alan Bates' delivery of the words from Women in Love. Joining me this evening, the author of The Burning Man, or Burning Man, The Ascent of D.H. Lawrence, Francis Wilson. Thanks for being with us this evening, Francis. I talked about these contradictions and the I suppose the divisive aspect of Lawrence himself. He started out being an absolute darling of the literary set, really, but it all went wrong. What happened?
Yes. Well, he started out being very much kind of fetishized as a working class writer. He was the first English working class novelist, and London Literary Society loved this, and they felt they could turn him into their little pet, you know, as long as he stuck to writing about working class subjects. So as long as he stuck to writing about life inside a coal miner's cottage, his father was a coal miner, and as long as he wrote about kind of the rural life of the part of the English Midlands he came from, that would be fine. But then when Lawrence decided that he, you know, this is not what he wanted to be known as. He didn't want to be classified according to his class at all. He wanted to do something audacious and dangerous with the novel and push it into another terrain. That's when things started to go wrong for him.
Are you going to blame Kate Millett and her PhD on the destruction of D.H. Lawrence's literary reputation?
Well, it must be the most effective PhD thesis ever written, wasn't it? But, yes, I think that it's interesting that you played that clip from Women in Love, because the film Women in Love came out 1 year before Kate Millett's PhD, Sexual Politics, was published. And so you could see that Lawrence's star was high, you know, in the late 60s, you know, and everyone thought that he was a bit like, he was Alan Bennett, he looked like Alan Bennett, you know, he was counterculturally cool in the same way that Che Guevara was. People thought of him as having invented sexual intercourse. And then Kate Millett, this American, very young American student at Columbia University in New York, published her PhD thesis in the form of a book called Sexual Politics, in which she accused D.H. Lawrence and Norman Mailer and Henry Miller of all being phallocentric misogynists. Now, Norman Mailer and Henry Miller were still alive, so they could kind of fight their corner. But Lawrence had been long dead. Lawrence had died in 1930. And so he couldn't speak up for himself. And it is extraordinary what happened, because Lawrence wasn't demonized in the way that people, when they're cancelled now, are instantly demonized. What happened to Lawrence was worse than that. He was seen as ridiculous.
Ah, yeah. So, but does Kate Millett? I mean, it's a PhD thesis that holds some water in terms of if you look at the early D.H. Lawrence, the early writer, versus D.H. Lawrence, the late writer. They're two very different writers talking about all of those aspects: sex, men and women, the dynamics between men and women, sexual power, sexual. Dynamics. Yes. He's talking about all of those things, but he speaks about them in very different ways from the beginning to the end. How would you characterise the difference between early Lawrence and late Lawrence?
Oh, yeah, it's the difference is so extreme. Yes, early Lawrence, I would say, was a very feminine writer who wrote about women from the inside. And late Lawrence was a misogynist. He wrote hateful stuff about women. He completely shifted. But this was very typical of Lawrence, you know, that he contained opposites, and he believed that, you know, that human beings did contain opposites, you know, that opposition was true friendship. And he started off his life feeling very sympathetic towards his mother. He'd grown up in a war zone. This is really kind of what, this is really the only way we can understand Lawrence. He'd grown up in a war zone with his parents continually battling. He was on his mother's side as a young boy. He saw his mother as very kind of victimized by his father's violence and his father's drinking his wages away in the local pub. They never had enough money. His mother had aspirations for her children. She wanted them to not go down the pit, but to lead more creative lives. And Lawrence then, halfway through his life, shifted his sympathy and started to feel incredibly sorry for his father. and realised that his mother had been had not been the victim that he thought she'd been. She'd actually been shrewish. And so he shifted his whole perspective and started to feel this huge sympathy for his father, and therefore started to, at the same time, kind of adulate big, silent men. And so then he turned his rage on women. So it wasn't women per se, it was his mother. He turned his rage on his mother.
And to what extent do you think he was? Where you say he enjoyed these, you know, these opposites, and saying, well, if you give a thesis, you're going to have to give the antithesis immediately, and only from that will you get synthesis. I suppose that's ultimately what he was saying in many ways. How consciously did he then say, okay, I've just believed A, now I'm going to believe Z for a period of time and see what comes out of those two opposites? I mean, was he consciously doing that?
It pretty much was conscious, yes. I mean, he got this philosophy from Blake. I mean, it was Blake's kind of in Blake's Proverbs of Hell, in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, that Blake said, you know, in all countries are human progression. You know, opposition is friendship. And Sir Lawrence based himself on Blake. But it also suited him down to the ground, because he was composed of contradictions and opposites. So what we got is a man who was, you know, very, very sexually puritanical. There was nothing pornographic about Lawrence at all. He loathed pornography, but yet he was seen as, you know, as the kind of the spirit of sexual freedom. This was not Lawrence. It's not like he was incredibly monogamous, and he was actually very, very squeamish about homosexuality, whilst also being probably a closeted homosexual himself. And so everything, every aspect of him contained its opposite, and he was at war with himself the whole time. And he did, as you say, he did write about this. He was pretty much aware of this as a fundamental part of his character, and he thought it was normal. He thought we were all like that.
What about his relationship with Freda Weekly, who would become his wife later on in life? How many opposites did that contain? It seemed to be full of love and war.
Yes, well, Frieda was his opposite in every way. I mean, physically, just take a look at them. You know, Frieda was a big, strong German woman, and she had a big bosom, and it got bigger. And Lawrence was a tiny, thin, tubercular man who got thinner and thinner. So as he got frailer throughout his life, Frieda got stronger. Frieda was what Lawrence very proudly called mindless. Because mindlessness was a huge compliment to him, for him, because he thought that the intellect had been hugely overrated, and that the body had its own intelligence, the body had its own set of instincts. And Frieda, who basically had sex with whoever she felt like having sex with, was living out the instincts of the body. But Lawrence was all intellect. So whilst he kind of worshipped and revered the life of the body, the life of his body was pretty terrible. I mean, he was dying for most of his life, and he was pure intellect. And so they were opposites, and he and Frieda fought, and they fought physically, and it horrified their friends. But this, the fighting that took place in the Lawrence household was very much part of their philosophy. You know, it was absolutely normal that they would, you know, find themselves rolling around on the ground, you know, punching each other, and then afterwards just talking about a delicious macaroni cheese they just enjoyed. It was as if nothing had happened.
Well, opposites are also present, obviously, in Lady Chatterley's Lover. Let's listen to a clip from the 1993 TV adaptation. Jolie Richardson playing Connie here, Lady Chatterley, and Sean Bean as Mellors the gardener, and Connie is visiting Mellors' hut in the woods.
So lovely here. I should like to come to the hut sometime, just to sit here and... You lock the door when you're not here, don't you?
Aye.
Are there two keys?
No.
Could you get another one?
Another key for the hut?
Yes. Don't you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, I understand, my lady. But where am I to find another key if Sir Clifford hasn't got one?
Well, has he another?
You mind, Tav?
Well, then I'll ask him for it.
I'm here a good bit by myself this time of year.
What do you mean?
I mean now the birds will start laying. I must find the eggs and put broody hens to sit.
Yes, I know.
Maybe you won't want to be here with only me around.
Only you around? Why on earth should I be afraid of being here alone with you?
Afraid, no. I only thought as you might not care for it like.
Sean Bean as Mallard the Gardener and Jodie Richardson as Connie Lady Chatterley from the 1993 TV adaptation of Lady Chatterley's Lover. And speaking to me this evening is Frances Wilson, the author of Burning Man, The Ascent of D.H. Lawrence. I wanted that clip in some ways, Frances, to display this, what you were saying about the intellect of D.H. Lawrence and how much that was at play. It's not as overt and as pornographic as people think of, really, in many ways, when you hear that book and that and any film adaptation of it. It's quite subtle, the kind of underplay or the kind of subtext that's at play in a scene like that.
Yes, that's right. And that's exactly what the kind of literary establishment said during the trial of Lady Chatterley in 1960, when Penguin Books were prosecuted for bringing out the first unexpurgated edition of the novel, which had been originally written in 1927. The whole literary establishment stood up in the witness box and said, this is not a pornographic book. This is a beautiful, subtle, sensitive exploration of love, physical and spiritual.
I'll finish up by saying that you mentioned there the trial around Lady Chatterley's Lover in 1960. Now, obviously, you were writing a biography of D.H. Lawrence, so that happened after he died. You couldn't do that. But is there another volume bursting to get out of you about that particular trial?
Oh, God. Of course. It was such a defining moment in British culture. Mm. Yes, I'd love to focus on what happened then, because it was the end of one era and the beginning of another.
Well, look forward to speaking to you when that comes around, Frances. Thanks for being with us this evening. Frances Wilson speaking to us about her current book, Burning Man, The Ascent of D.H. Lawrence, which is published by Bloomsbury. And that is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Kishihi will be with you tomorrow night. We'll be back with you with a special programme on Bank Holiday Monday. And then I'll be back with you again on Wednesday. So have a good bank holiday weekend. Enjoy yourselves when it comes about.